Good morning, everyone. I'm Mark McClellan. I'm the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform here at the Brookings Institution. I'd like to thank you all for joining us. In many cases, you'll be joining us again for the final webinar of our series of three, our Sentinel Initiative 101, our overview of the Sentinel Initiative series. As you've heard in the previous webinars on this set of topics, there are a number of different and very active initiatives going on as part of the Sentinel Initiative, and we've been trying to cover the set of those. Today's webinar is going to conclude the series with overviews of the Federal Partners Collaboration, what's going on in Sentinel-related activities within federal government programs and data systems, and the Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership, also known as OMOP, what's going on there with really some cutting-edge work on methods and analytic techniques for supporting Sentinel-type activities throughout all of the Sentinel initiatives. And then the Brookings Institution's convening activities, the meetings, the workshops, the gatherings that we've held and are continuing to hold to try to help move this entire important set of safety initiatives along. To cover these topics, we've got some great speakers today. We're going to start with Melissa Robb, who's the project director for the Sentinel Initiative in the Office of Medical Policy at the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research in the FDA. She's going to describe the work of the Federal Partners Collaboration and quite an impressive set of accomplishments there already. Then Paul Stang, who's the director of senior director of epidemiology for Johnson & Johnson and the principal investigator of the Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership, is going to provide an update of OMOP's many research activities and lessons learned so far, again, focusing on the methods and learning and drawing conclusions from Sentinel-type studies. Excuse me. And then finally, and definitely not least, we have Josh Benner, who's a fellow in economic studies and managing director here at the Engelberg Center, leading our portfolio of work with the FDA, and in particular putting a major effort into these Sentinel initiative activities. Josh is going to give an overview of the range of meetings convened by the Brookings Institution and where some of those activities are headed in the future as well. Today's roundtable is going to be an online web presentation. At this point, all of your lines should be automatically muted, but to make sure everybody can hear well, it'd be great if you could confirm that. You can confirm that your phone or computer is muted by on the phone simply pressing *6. To unmute the phone if you have a question later or want to speak, just press *7. And during the presentations, we encourage you to use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen for the webinar. You can submit questions or comments at any time during the presentations. They'll be put into a queue, and this enables us to get to you as quickly and in an orderly way as possible during our discussion time, which we intend to have later on in the hour. At the end of the session, if time permits, we're going to open up the lines to those of you participating only by phone to ask questions. So again, in the meantime, it's *6 to mute, which we hope everybody's doing now, or just pressing the mute button on your phone, *7 to unmute when you have a question or comment later. If you have any technical problems with any aspect of the webinar, please call the Brookings IT Help Desk at 202-797-6193, 202-797-6193. So again, after the presentations, we'll be opening up the lines for questions and comments, and you can submit them at any time during the presentation via the Q&A tab. So now I'd like to get started since we have so much ground to cover today. Melissa, I hope you're with us. If you could press *7 to unmute your line and get going, I know we'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, Mark. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. So as Mark said, I am Melissa Robin, the project director for the Sentinel Initiative, and I wanted to provide you with a brief update about our work with our federal partners and how it relates to the Sentinel Initiative. Rich Flatt had provided a presentation last week about Mini Sentinel, which is our pilot ongoing with private data holders, but under FDA there was a requirement also that we work collaboratively with our federal partners, and so we launched the Federal Partners Collaboration. I'm having a little trouble moving my, I got it, sorry. So the Federal Partners Collaboration was initiated through the Safer Us Project, which was actually a collaboration between CMS and FDA, which was launched in 2008 when the Medicare Part D data became available for research purposes. And that was actually the same time as the launch of the Sentinel Initiative. And with some assistance from the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at the Department of Health and Human Services, SafeRx was launched as a collaboration between CMS and FDA to use the data contained for safety surveillance evaluations and for full epidemiology studies. Prior to the launch of this program, FDA had already been collaborating with CMS, but was only able to use the data captured in Medicare Part B. So having this other prescription data really expanded our ability to evaluate medical products. And we continue to work on projects with CMS individually in all of the different medical product centers, the Center for Drugs, the Center for Biologics, and the Center for Devices, looking at Medicare and Medicaid data to assess safety of our regulated products. So the Federal Partners Collaboration, we expanded the collaboration of SafeRx and started working with DOD and VA. And what we tried to create was our own small distributed system among our federal partners where the data resided or remained with either CMS, DOD, and VA, and we didn't centralize the data. And we also didn't create a common data model. This is a little different than our mini Sentinel pilot, which has the same distributed approach, but for the first step in that evaluation process, the data is transformed into a common format to allow centralized analytics to be run. Some logistical and resourcing concerns were the reason that we were unable to implement a common data model among the partners. But we also thought it would be provide us the ability to look at the two different approaches and understand the pros and cons of the different approaches. FDA, an evaluation begins with FDA proposing a medical product and adverse outcome to be evaluated. And then we look at the different data partners' data to better understand if they have enough exposures and populations to actually conduct the evaluation. We also try to make sure that the evaluations that we conduct are of mutual interest to all of the partners. After we've decided on a medical product for a signal or a safety signal to evaluate, we work together to develop a shared protocol, and we have to consider the different types of information captured in each of the partners' data, and we also have to consider the different coding, but we have to really make sure that we, because of the fact that we don't have a common data model and we're not using a common analytical program, we need to make sure it's very clear up front what we're hoping to evaluate, how we define that, and so that everybody can take that and implement it within their own systems in a consistent way. And finally, once these protocols are completed, we work together collaboratively to analyze the results and to assess the interpretability among our different environments. So one of the quick learnings that we had with this project is that since we aren't using this common data model, it's really important that we take the time up front to make sure that we're all looking at the problem in the same way and that we're defining our populations and our outcomes consistently. So our CMS contractor, Acumen, has developed a template for us to help facilitate the planning of the different assessments. And the templates are essentially in two different phases. And the first phase allows us to define the treatments and the outcomes and the related health circumstances and medical interventions of the different cohorts so that we can make sure that we're applying inclusion and exclusion criteria similarly among the different partners. The next phase, we really focus on the populations so that we're drawing in comparable populations for the outcome events. And we found that these tools are very helpful for making sure that we're all working from the same page. I mean, they don't replace a protocol, but we refine these templates through iterations in our experience and have really helped refine our understanding of the questions. And we've even started to use them in some one-off studies that we do with these different partners for other types of evaluations. Some examples of assessments that we've conducted include the antiviral drugs and neuropsychiatric adverse events. That was our first initial evaluation, and with the H1N1 epidemic that had come up a couple years ago, there was some concerns that with the increased use of antiviral drugs, that this was an opportunity for us to better understand the adverse events that had been somewhat reported with some of these drugs. And so we conducted an evaluation within our federal partners looking at some of these events with antiviral drugs. Since then, we've also followed on to look at dronedarone and heart failure based on some earlier issues that had arisen as a potential safety signal. As we think about ongoing challenges as we work in this collaboration, there are some limits to the analysis approaches with rare outcomes, and I think that's typical of working within this environment. We also have to worry about developing approaches to make the most of claims data and the validation. So our concerns are that not all of our federal partners have the ability to access source data for validation of health outcomes of interest. So we're trying to think about if there's other ways to use the data available to them within their claims environments to better understand if there's other outcomes or other conditions that would make us reliably think that the outcome of interest did occur. And so we're working with all three of our federal partners to think about approaches to validation in the absence of medical records. And I think the third challenge that we're working through or has become apparent is that the federal partner populations are very different. CMS has typically an older population. DOD usually has a much younger active duty population, but does have some retirees also that it captures information. And VA is also an older population. And so the interpretability of the findings is something that needs to be considered. And also the clinical guidelines and practices within these different systems needs to be considered when we're looking at the comparability of the results. And so since these populations do differ, it's good that we have the assistance of working with our federal partners to help us think about the interpretation and the regulatory impact that the findings have. So we've learned a lot with these initial evaluations, and we're really working to streamline our collaboration and the ability to look at different medical products and adverse outcomes to better understand them and how this information can help contribute to the post-marketing surveillance of our medical products. So that's all I have about the Federal Partners Collaboration.
Thanks very much, Melissa. I think for those of you on the line, we're going to hold your questions until we get to the end of the presentation so that we can keep things moving. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Paul. Paul, can you hear us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Sound great. Go ahead.
Thanks, Josh, and thanks, Melissa. The work I'm going to present is clearly on behalf of a number of people, my collaborators at OMA, but did want to give you a sense of what we've been up to, but also want to make it clear that everything that we produce, our papers, our software programs, presentations, can all be found on the website, and that address is in front of you. I'm also having trouble advancing the slides here.
Try the arrow keys in the lower left corner of the screen.
In the lower left.
Should be an up arrow and a down
arrow.
Got
it. Okay. Thanks. Sorry. So we just want to make sure that we all kind of start out on the same page. When we think about analyses from these databases, we're thinking of them as just another source among many sources that provides some evidence to support or refute a decision or a safety assessment. And here are kind of the classic types of information that we see in these types of analyses. And ours is just contributing one more piece to that evidence base. What I'm about to discuss can be characterized, or the type of work we're doing and others are doing can be characterized as anything along the spectrum of risk identification to more formal analysis. We're focused pretty much up on the upstream side of risk identification and risk amplification, but I just wanted to make it clear that we see this as one piece of a larger puzzle that helps everybody come to some decision. So the Observational Medical Outcomes Partnership was launched in February of 2009. What I'm going to present today is kind of a real top-line summary. I'm going to try and hit some of the high points and give you a sense of what we've been up to. But again, encourage you, if you want to, if you haven't heard this before or want more detail, please visit the website. To characterize what we're doing, we're basically a group that's focused on conducting empirical research. So we're trying to use an empirical approach that really attempts to understand the boundaries and performance characteristics of the methods, the data, the definitions that we use as they're applied to these observational data sets. So in broader terms, we're really testing the functionality not just of the science, but how it's put together under a governance structure. And I'll talk a little bit more about that governance structure in a couple of slides later. But in general, it consists of an executive committee and two advisory boards. One's a scientific advisory board, and one's an informatics advisory board. And all that's bundled up into a public-private partnership. We're really focused on empiric assessments, and along the way, we have developed tools and capabilities and insights that we think are pretty valuable to the field. This next slide, many of you have seen a number of times, but we start with a group of data sources. We house five of them internally in a central lab. We have a distributed network. We're calling it, we have a research core and our distributed partners. That's essentially 10 data sources altogether. We purposely tried to select data sources that represent different types of data and different ways that data were captured. So we do have electronic health record. We do have claims, but we also have regional healthcare exchange data, point of care data, again, a mix of different types of data, all told around 200 million lives as part of the OMOP experiment. Each of these data sets, and parallel to that, we've got a lot of methods development going on. So we've gone out to the literature, to experts. We've actually held a methods contest called the OMOP Cup, where we're trying to identify all the possible methods that could be applied to identify an association between an exposure and an outcome in these types of data. So we then take the data sources themselves, convert them to a common data model. It's a standards-based common data model, and we apply the methods to them, seeking to identify what we've already defined or predetermined to be true truths and true falses. So we're looking for truth in the data represented both as relationships that we would assume that we would find based on a systematic literature review process that identified the true associations, as well as a similar process that identified within the same set of 10 drugs associations that we would not expect to see. So those became our true-false or our negative cases, as it were. So that helps us apply the methods to be able to identify when it finds true signals or true associations, as well as when it may generate false positives. I mentioned the governance structure. We've also, in the course of the execution of our research, developed a number of tools, and again, these are available on the website. The tools in the infrastructure include the common data model with vocabularies and taxonomies, which are the standards where all of the data sets have been converted into. SNOMED is our condition standard, LOINC codes are our laboratory standard, and RxNorm is what we've used for medications. Notably, those are consistent with the ONC Meaningful Use Stage 2 recommendations. So we feel like we've aligned there at some level. There's also a number of tools and routines that have been developed along the way that help us summarize the data and get some insight into the populations that they represent. Some of those tools can be useful for disease natural history, data quality, or identifying and focusing more detailed work in a particular cohort of individuals. All of these methods and all of these tools have been coded and placed in libraries, again, accessed on our website. So in the process, we've also had a systematic way of identifying literature, search strategies that we've tried to optimize to identify observational studies for these health outcomes of interest. And we've also identified the spectrum of ways that these health outcomes of interest could be defined in these data. So instead of selecting one particular definition for acute myocardial infarction, we're actually testing several different ways to define that concept, again, as part of the entire experiment of looking at optimizing some of the decision that goes on here. We've also developed, and I'll talk about a little bit later, a simulator, a piece of software that actually creates data sets where the operator can infuse associations of known strength that represent actual truth against which they can test methods performance. So we felt like this was a great success. It's actually called OSIM2. It's the second iteration of this piece of work, and it seems to perform very well and mimics the structure of the existing observational data sets very closely. So those are the general parts that you'll find in the OMOP effort. OMOP in its core is really about variability and diversity. We're looking across different types of data. We're looking across different methods and different settings and decisions that are made when those methods are applied. We're looking across different populations represented in those data, different comparators that could be selected as part of the methods application, different ways to define both the exposures and the outcomes. And at the end of the day, with all of this variability, we're hoping that it'll help us go much further in characterizing the method's performance, but also helping us identify the optimum combination of these choices so that we can be more efficient and better at identifying potential associations of interest for further study. Here's an example of one of the outputs and one of the tools. When you have a network of databases, you can do what people used to call benchmarking, but you can also do a little comparison to see how the populations may differ. So this is one of our data sources. It's Regan Streiff Institute, which is a regional health exchange. And it's basically the prevalence based on diagnosis codes of various diseases represented by those codes compared to the rest of the network. And you can see in orange and red some of the more prevalent, or at least some of the diagnoses that are more prevalent in that population as compared to the rest of the network. We've used similar approaches to identify not only differences among the populations, but potentially some quality issues when you start looking at individual data sets versus a norm across a number of different data sets. But this is a representation of basically the prevalence of, and the prevalence here is being represented by the size of the rectangle. The color of the rectangle, which you may not be able to read, is the relative prevalence or the prevalence ratio compared to the network norm. So orange and red are those prevalence ratios that are above 1.5. and they're kind of distributed in clusters around organ classes or therapeutic areas. It's just one of the types of visualizations that we've been working with. The traditional epidemiology effort, or the traditional pharmacoepidemiology effort, tends to focus on a single data source, applying a specific method with specific definitions for exposures and outcomes, again, in a particular database. That's pretty much how it's been, and you derive a relative risk or some relative measure against some comparator. So there's several choices that are made. This example is angioedema and ACE inhibitors in a particular database using one method. Let me just skip through this a little bit. When you think about a network of databases and some of the possible choices, not only of methods but definitions, you can start looking at some of that variability that I mentioned previously. So here we're looking across on the y-axis are the data sources using just, in this case, one method. And you can see that there is some variation, but at least they're all consistent in identifying the association between angioedema and ACE inhibitors. And those are the data sources, and here's the single method. And now if we open it up and look across multiple methods, again, still studying ACE inhibitors and angioedema, we can start seeing the amount of consistency that might be present when you're looking across multiple data sources and multiple methods. So for the most part, all of the methods are identifying the association significantly between ACE inhibitors and angioedema. Now, if we looked at the converse, which was one of our negative controls, where we didn't expect to see a relationship, we actually were a little bit surprised, because what we found was a fairly consistent finding of a positive association where we expected to not see a positive association. So this one is antibiotics and acute renal failure, and there are a number of reasons why this could have arisen, and that's part of what we're continuing to study is what are some of the reasons this could have happened, and for the epidemiologists on the phone, you can think of any number of things, protopathic bias, all kinds of potential biases, but the interesting thing is some of these findings arise even with analytic strategies and methods that were designed to address those particular issues. So here we see a pretty consistent pattern of a false positive across data sources and across methods. So as I mentioned, one of the main things we're focused on is characterizing methods performance. Here's the typical 2x2 table, and if we just kind of walk through the usual way we assess a screening test or a diagnostic test, it kind of follows the same pattern. So, you know, we can certainly, once we apply them to our test cases, we can look at methods performance in terms of sensitivity, specificity. This one has a false positive rate of 18%. We can look at positive predictive value, negative predictive value, and accuracy. So in this example, with this particular method, there's a precision of 38% and a false positive rate of 18%. With 77% accuracy. So we're, again, spending the next few months looking a little bit more closely and digging a little bit more deeply into our test cases to understand what things we could change and vary and dig deep into those settings to identify which settings seem to be driving changes in these different parameters, different outputs, again, to optimize the method and how it's applied. So here's a kind of composite picture where, again, I'm going to kind of drive home this point about variability. It's all the test cases, both positives and negatives, to begin to see how well a given method may perform across all the test cases. Again, it's a single method I'm showing here across all of the positives and negative cases. And you can see there's some variation. Up here are where all the true positives are, and all here are the true negatives. And you can see that it's finding a lot of the true negatives, but it's also signaling some false positives here in the red. What we want to see up here is mostly green, and what we want to see below that should be mostly blue. If we expand that, this is just labeling where some of the false positives occurred. But if we expand that out across a number of different methods, here especially on the left, you see a lot of green for two of these methods, case control surveillance and case crossover. In fact, look like they found all of the true associations, but it's essentially at the expense of also finding true associations where we really shouldn't have been finding true associations. So it's signaling a lot of false positives. So in a crude sense, they've become generators of associations when, in fact, the association may not have been there. And it's just another way that we're looking at methods performance. Again, the composite of how the methods stacked up in terms of prediction and false positive rate. Again, we're walking this fine line between how high a false positive rate we're willing to tolerate for what return on sensitivity. There's no obvious best method, as you can kind of determine from this composite. Now, this is a composite of a lot of different settings and a lot of different outcomes, so that's part of our energy is being spent looking at particular combinations, particular situations to see if there are places where certain methods seem to perform better than others, for example, rare events or high background rates. In the end, we really are looking at a trade-off between false positive and false negative rates. So at the moment, all the methods at a summary level are trending around a false positive rate around 15%, which really isn't too bad, given what we've been reading from some of the other network efforts that have been going on. Here's ROC curves, which some of you may be familiar with, is another way of looking at how methods perform and showing a large ranges of the sensitivities and the false positive rates. Again, we see the methods in general are performing somewhere in the order of 58 to 77%, which is actually in the ballpark of a lot of the diagnostic screening tests that are used in primary care. When we went back to the literature and looked to see where this stacks up in terms of the broader world of medical care and screening, it wasn't too far off. It's not ideal, and in particular when you think about the impact that a decision based on this data may have at a population level, I think that's where we start to get concerned. We also start to get concerned with higher false positive rates, in part because of the energy and resources and approach that may need to be put into place to identify something as a false positive or act on it if it's felt to be something that needs to be evaluated further. So where are we headed now, or what are we in the midst of now? We have decided for the next while here to focus on four particular health outcomes of interest: myocardial infarction, upper GI bleed, acute liver injury, and acute renal failure. We also quickly came to the conclusion that the 10 drug HOI pairs that we were studying was a really small sample on which to make any summary statements about methods performance. So we're going through the exercise now of identifying a much broader number of test cases that we can use in our studies. Right now, and I think the number is slightly changing as we go through this, but we've identified an additional 166 positive associations that we want to put through the test, as well as 375 negative or associations we would not expect based on the lack of evidence we would not expect to see. We also have a number of collaborations going on, formal and informal, and those of you familiar with the EUADR group, another network operating in this space in Europe, they're also participating with us and replicating some of our efforts moving forward in a subset of their sites. On the methods side, we're funding and collaborating in additional enhancements to methods. We still have our eyes open for new methods, but we're spending a fair amount of energy trying to really understand at a pretty granular level the methods that we've already been working with. We still want to look at how best to characterize those methods, and along with refining some of our HOI definitions, see if we can't increase the performance over what we've seen so far. We're about to launch a large survey effort called EDI, where we want to capture information about the types of decisions and the spectrum of decisions that an epidemiologist would make given a certain situation. And here again, it's to help us put boundaries around what would be considered rational study decisions, to try and then turn that into a quantification of how the performance would be under that set of choices. So that's to be launched probably by the end of September, and probably many of you on the phone will be receiving an email solicitation to participate in what's called the EDI survey. We're also expanding our common data model. I think Melissa mentioned a little bit about common data models. We're expanding ours to be able to incorporate additional use cases, and that work is ongoing as well. As I mentioned, we've got some collaboration going with EUADR. We've also been in contact with some other networks that are interested in using some of our tools, but also working with us on building our network using our common data model. And finally, I had mentioned before the simulator, OSIM2, which will give us a new tool to really empirically test in with known truths and known strengths of associations the performance characteristics of the data sets that, or the types of data that we're working with. But in part, that's really been developed to allow us the ability to work in a data set where we know what truth is. Currently, that's not the case in the observational databases. I also wanted to just point to you another project that's around how do we make all this information useful in a framework that's familiar to people. And one framework a lot of us were raised on were the Hill's causality viewpoints. And Patrick, in particular, had gone through an exercise of trying to match up Hill's causal criteria with what we could get out of a observational database and how it would line up. And this is just a screenshot of the dashboard, kind of as a mock-up to understand how a dashboard like this could be generated from this type of data to represent graphically the features of the Hill's causal criteria. I'll just point to temporality. We've done a lot of descriptive work in some of the drug HOI pairs, and here what you can't see with any great precision, but here's the rate of events or the number of events occurring after the index date for the first exposure, and it just shows you that there is a little bit of a background rate that occurs prior to initial exposure to a product, but that the majority, in this particular test case, the majority of the events of interest were occurring after the index exposure. And there are a number of other, as you can see, pretty colorful graphic outputs that we've shown at one or two meetings and actually received some very good feedback and very positive feedback and support for working a little bit more on that. So let me just summarize here. OMOP's undertaking and continues to undertake empiric research in hopes that we are able to characterize methods performance in observational data. We have a very open, transparent model. Everything that we produce, as long as it doesn't jeopardize our publication, is posted on our website, and that includes software, white papers, presentations, and the like. To date, we have not identified one singular clear best method, but we think we have developed a research plan that helps us characterize and see a way forward to dig a little deeper in some very specific HOIs to get closer to identifying optimal deployment of certain methods in these types of data. We'll be working on that for the foreseeable future, and welcome, certainly, collaboration from those of you on the phone, friends and family. Again, here's the website address. Tom Skarnecki is our executive director and serves as our main point of contact. So, Josh, I think I'll turn it back over to you.
Thanks very much, Paul. And once again, those of you with questions or comments on the OMOP work or the federal partners work can send us your questions through the online tool, the webinar system, and we'll begin calling on folks at the conclusion of the presentations. So I'm going to move us through the final few slides. Once again, I'm Josh Benner. I'm a fellow in economic studies and managing director here at the Engelberg Center. And I'm going to talk just for a few moments about Brookings convening activities related to the Sentinel Initiative, and specifically some of the opportunities for those of you online today to become involved in and have a voice in the ongoing discussions around these activities. So the first thing I want to point out is that we have a very simple goal for our convening work here at Brookings with respect to the Sentinel Initiative, and that's simply to provide a forum for in-depth discussion of the Sentinel Initiative and related activities involving all interested stakeholders. And we do that in a couple of ways. One is by actively trying to gather the perspectives and potential solutions to the many policy and technical issues that arise in such a large and complex project. And secondly, then, to report on the proceedings of those discussions and those meetings in a way that the output of it, of those discussions can be shared broadly. And so there are roughly four different kinds of convening activities that we conduct throughout the year. This is a multi-year project under a cooperative agreement with grant funding from FDA. And the four types of activities are shown on the slide here. So the first is roundtable webinars, and we're doing one of those right now. These happen every 1 to 2 months, and they cover a diverse range of pilot activities or initiatives relevant to active surveillance and Sentinel's ongoing development. And as you all know, they're open to all interested stakeholders. The second kind of activity are expert workshops. These tend to be smaller meetings. They are focused generally on specific policy or technical topics that might inform Sentinel's ongoing development. And we invite to those meetings subject matter experts who have expertise on the given topic for the meeting. The third type of activity are Brookings Active Surveillance Implementation Council meetings. These are still smaller workshops, generally focused on issues related to implementation of the Sentinel system over the longer term. And the people who attend these meetings tend to be senior leaders from stakeholder groups involved in these activities. And then finally, we offer an annual public stakeholder workshop. And this is a large annual meeting that provides a forum for all interested stakeholders to engage in dialogue about the direction of all these activities, hear from FDA and all of its partners involved in implementation, and again, have a voice in the discussion about next steps. So once again, those are open to all interested stakeholders. Just to give you a flavor for some of the topics that we've covered at previous meetings, you can see it's an assortment of both technical and policy issues. On the technical side, we've taken on topics like the infrastructure for conducting distributed data analysis, different methods for conducting signal refinement, statistical issues in both signal detection and signal refinement, and what the priorities ought to be going forward for ongoing methods research and development, building on the important work that Paul and the OMOP team and others in the Mini Sentinel team have been doing. On the policy side, there are an assortment of issues as well, including legal and privacy issues, policies for how the results of Sentinel analyses and related work will be communicated, and the role of both data partners and analytic partners, as well as the regulated industry in all of these activities. So the common theme here, as you can see, is trying to ensure that this is a sustainable system based on the most rigorous and best possible methods and policies that make it possible for all the essential stakeholders to be involved. I also want to point out that we are always open to new topics that are of interest to stakeholders and getting to know new experts on these topics. And so here are some of the opportunities for additional involvement. In particular, I want to call your attention to the Active Surveillance Roundtable webinars like this one, which, as I said earlier, are held every 1 to 2 months. And if you'd like to make sure you're on the mailing list for those in the future, you can send an email to one of the addresses below. It's also good to go ahead and put on the calendar the annual public workshop on the Sentinel Initiative, which will be held on January 18th here in Washington, D.C. at the Marriott Metro Center. The two folks that you can email directly to make sure that you're aware of these events and to express your interest in future topics or suggest future topics are Sally Clucci and Michelle Wong. And as I said, their email addresses are shown on the screen. For those of you who are attending by phone only, I'll just give you Michelle's email address, which is mwong, W-O-N-G, at brookings.edu. And then finally, you can, of course, follow our work online. The Brookings website contains summaries of all of our different meetings, and it's provided there at brookings.edu/health. And then finally, the FDA's Sentinel website is set up to provide updates on these meetings. So we look forward to hearing from all of you and working with all of you on these issues in the near future. And I'll turn it back over to Mark to moderate our Q&A today.
Josh, thank you. And also a special thanks to Melissa and Paul for covering a lot of ground in a limited amount of time. We do have some time left for questions and comments. And some of you have submitted these already. If there are others, remember you can use the Q&A tab at any time. To start off, actually before we go to questions, we'd just like to remind everyone again, Josh mentioned January 18th for the next annual public meeting on Sentinel issues. There's going to be a lot to talk about at that meeting, and we encourage you to hold the date, so January 18th here in Washington. Going to the questions, I have one for Melissa Robb from James Miller. James, if you're on, could you press star 7 to unmute your phone and then go ahead with your question. Okay, not hearing James, but the question he did submit was a good one, Melissa, which is that when FDA does a study through Sentinel on a particular product, will the sponsor be notified and given access to the data? And I guess that's particularly an issue for the federal data side.
So that's an issue actually we're working with in both of our pilots, in Mini Sentinel and the Federal Partners Collaboration. And we're trying to put together policies to make sure that sponsors and the public are informed about the evaluations that we're working on and some of the specifics and the protocol. Within Mini Sentinel, we posted our first initial protocol for the assessment that's being planned. And I think we need to develop some approaches to also think about how that can be done within our federal partners' work. As far as results, I think we agree that it's important for people to be aware, especially sponsors, of the results and the information we have about the products that they are ultimately responsible for, and we're similarly trying to think of the appropriate way to get that information to everybody.
Hey, thanks, Melissa. Sounds like some more guidance coming on that, too. It's a very important issue. I have a question for Paul from Lourdes Frau. Lourdes, if you're still on, can you press star 7 to unmute and ask your question?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Sure. Paul, again, how are you planning to define or address the operational aspects of all these methods that you're putting together for the what I call the daily conduct of safety surveillance? Namely, how are you going to make this, how are you going to apply these methods, or are you going to analyze how to apply them realistically for day-to-day conduct of surveillance?
Am I on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. So, Lourdes, are you asking, are we also going to be looking at whether or not this is a method that should be applied with regular updates of the data, or is that where you wanted to go with that question?
Well, you're developing methods. Can they be applied on a daily basis? Can these be used by a company to do active surveillance on a reasonable basis?
Absolutely. Okay, so that's a very good question.
How are you going to say how can this hypothetical statistical methods that you're using, how can this be operationalized?
Right. So we know that a number of organizations and manufacturers are actually taking on board the common data model and starting to apply these methods inside their own set of data sources. Where we haven't gotten to yet is that whole discussion about frequency and all of the statistical underpinnings when you do multiple looks at the same data using the same method over time. There are, you know, the sequential methods, which are kind of in our sights down the road, but those are some discussions that we're hoping to have when we have a little bit more depth of information about how these methods have performed in the larger set of drug HOI pairs. That's a very fair question about operationalizing them. Again, we have to keep bringing ourselves back to the idea that if it's being applied as a monitoring type of effort, it may be considered a different type of evidence than if it's being applied as something closer to a formal evaluation.
But essentially the intent of Sentinel and some of the other approaches is to do surveillance, daily active safety surveillance.
Right. But
so that's operationalizing on a daily basis.
On some regular basis, but I think there's still a lot of discussion being had as to where the line is drawn between how these methods are applied and how, if at all, they're different from a more formal evaluation study. And I think that's been a lot of discussion in some of the meetings that many of us have been in.
Great question as the Sentinel activities continue to evolve. Paul, I had another question for you from Jeff Sivertson. Jeff, if you're still on, can you press *7 and ask your question?
Yeah, this is Luke Popovich. I'm sitting with Jeff, actually, and I had a question about all the data generated from these initiatives and activities. From this end, how would we be able to access this? Is this something that's going to be available for us to access? Would it be a web, have we thought that far in advance about how we would get access to this data to be able to look at it and use it for our purposes?
Yeah, so.
Paul, I think you should feel free to comment on that, but Melissa, maybe I can put you on the spot for that too.
So, Melissa, do you want to start or do you want me to?
Go ahead, Paul.
So OMOP has a research lab that houses our data currently, and we entertain a number of collaborators who are working on methods. And it's a simple process to apply to get access to the data and the tools. And, you know, if you're a SaaS user, you know, be a part of the SaaS license. We've got, I think, somewhere between 50 and 100 active research collaborators using it now. Some of them are funded specifically through funds that we've received to focus in particular areas of interest that have been identified. Others are following through on either their own line of work or an academic pursuit. But there is, you should contact Tom Skarnecchia, and he can give you a sense of how to get through the application process to gain access. But we meant to set it up as a resource for further methods research.
Melissa, anything to add on the federal side?
Right. Our work with both our federal partners and our mini Sentinel is operationalized through interagency agreements and federal contracts, and that provides FDA access to that data. But I think as part of the broader vision for the Sentinel initiative, we try to think of how this can be a part of a national resource, realizing that other researchers would want to have access to this data for purposes of safety surveillance and other purposes, other secondary uses for evaluations related to medical products. So we're actively involved in a dialogue of thinking about how we can further the work that we've done under the Sentinel Initiative to move towards a national resource that others could also use this data for their purposes.
Thanks, Melissa. We have just a couple of minutes left. If there is anyone on the phone who hasn't submitted a question but would like to ask one, this would be a great time to press *7 on mute and ask your question. Any anyone out there on the phone who has something else to ask for this webinar.
Hello? Can you hear
me?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, this is Tong Tong Wang from Health Canada. I'm an epidemiologist here. I have a question for Paul. Regarding your methods of measuring method performance example, I'm just wondering how do you define the true association or negative control? Where do you find this values, or does it just include the direction, which is negative or positive association, or it also include the magnitude of estimator?
Yeah, that's a good question. We had developed a formal process of looking for evidence in the published literature and then going to our scientific advisors to vet a smaller subset of potential true associations. Some of what we required were published evidence in an observational database, mention in certain parts of the package insert for the product or the class of products. And for the negative controls, we stayed within the same drugs and basically used, in a sense, the inverse of those requirements. We actually started that whole process with identifying what are the key outcomes of interest that are of interest to this community. And I believe we started with the FDA's designated medical events list as a starting point and asked people to submit others. So we had a process that we went through. Having seen the results when we've gone back and looked at the drug HOI pairs, and we readily admitted it up front, practice could have changed. These are fairly mature products that we started with. So practice patterns could have changed, and it would have altered the association that we might have seen. So we accept that some of those drug HOI pairs may not have been persistent enough in the current data to have shown up. And there's some questions about whether or not some of them were essentially due to bias that was unmeasured in the original studies.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Great question. We have time for maybe one more if there are any others out there. Well, thank you all very much. We're about at the end of the hour, and these are some great questions at the end here that go to some of the challenges ahead for Sentinel in terms of how the methods are actually going to be applied on an ongoing and as you said, more routine basis, how others might have access to the data sets, and how this is all going to end up fitting together. I'm glad to see the international interest in this set of initiatives, too. So this goes to the importance of the work that our presenters are doing. I'd like to thank all of them again for their very interesting and informative presentations. Clearly, there's a lot going on with the Sentinel Initiative and a lot still to come. So this kind of back and forth is extremely helpful. Josh mentioned some other ways outside of our ongoing webinars and public meetings for feedback and input for helping to improve the Sentinel system and helping to make sure all of these issues are addressed as effectively as possible with the goal of improving evidence to protect the public health. We're looking forward to those further opportunities with you, and again, hope we will see you at the next public meeting on January 18th, and look forward to any feedback via email or some of the other mechanisms that Josh described earlier. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining us for this update series on Sentinel 101 and where the initiative is headed. Presentation materials from today's webinar are going to be posted on the Brookings website within the next few days, so you can have access to them there. We are planning our next webinars for the fall. We're still working on confirming the exact topics and dates, but you should look for announcements coming from us on these future webinars in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, we hope you have a great afternoon. Thanks again.